Hi, this is Steve Meyer, and I want to thank you for being a regular listener of the ID the Future podcast. We appreciate your interest in intelligent design and the work we're doing to develop the case for the theory of intelligent design. And I'd like to encourage you, if you find these broadcasts edifying, intellectually or otherwise, to become a regular financial supporter of the work of the Center for Science and Culture. You may know that we depend entirely on private donations. We don't get any federal money. We don't get government money for our scientific research program. And if you find the work that we're doing interesting, we'd be awfully grateful if you'd consider becoming a partner in that work by providing whatever you're able to ensure that that work goes forward.
Please help support ID the Future with a financial donation. You can pledge your support at discovery.org/IDTF2018. That's discovery.org/IDTF2018. Thanks for continuing to make these podcasts possible. Now, on with the next episode of ID the Future.
Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, and today we're picking up where we left off with an interview with Dr. Wolf Eckhard Lonick, formerly a senior scientist and researcher at the Max Planck Institute for Plant Breeding Research in Cologne, Germany. In the previous podcast, Dr. Lonick explained to us how Darwinian evolution actually hindered the acceptance of Mendel's laws of genetics. So Dr. Lonick, I know that in the 20th century, there were historians of biology who commented on whether Darwinian thinking hindered the progress of science and sort of prevented biologists from accepting Mendel's laws of inheritance. Could you please comment on this for us?
In the late 20th century, there were two historians of biology. It is Callender, and just listen to the headlines of their papers, Gregor Mendel, an opponent of decent with modifications, was in 1988. And E.B. Bishop in 1996, paper topic was Mendel's opposition to evolution and to Darwin. First, I'm going to make a short quote of Mendel in 1866, and he writes, Gärtner, there was a botanist who studied hybrids and their descendants. By the results of these transformation experiments, which showed clear limits of evolution, was added by me now, to make this quotation more clear, was led to oppose the opinion of those naturalists who dispute the stability of plant species and believe in a continuous evolution of vegetation. This is all Mendel. He perceives in the complete transformation of one species into another an indubitable proof that species are fixed with limits beyond which they cannot change. Now Mendel continues, although this opinion cannot be unconditionally accepted, we find on the other hand in Gärtner's experiments a noteworthy confirmation of that supposition regarding variability of cultivated plants, which has already been expressed. Well, in my own words, Gärtner made experiments, so-called transformation experiments, and found limits to evolution. He found clear limits to evolution. He could not vary these plants indefinitely, and that's why he came to the conclusion that species are fixed within limits beyond which they cannot change. And Callender now commented in 1988, quote, despite its clarity, this paragraph has been a source of endless confusion in the literature. If this statement is to be taken literally, as Mendel most assuredly intended it to be taken, then it says quite simply that Mendel gave conditional acceptance to the view expressed by Gärtner that species are fixed within limits beyond which they cannot change. Nothing could be clearer, says Callender. Nevertheless, interpretation of this passage have been given which are remarkable for their extreme departure from accepted use in both the German and English languages. So, what was in the minds of these people who produced the extreme departures of the accepted use of both the German and English languages. It could not be true that a genius like Gregor Mendel, having discovered the foundations of the true laws of heredity, could have opposed the theory of evolution. And that's why the endless amount of interpretations of that sentence, which is so clear, namely that species are fixed within limits beyond which they cannot change. This was a conditional acceptance of Mendel of that view.
So, Dr. Lohnig, what is the current thinking on this topic today?
Well, there are still many contradictory explanations. Mendel was a monk behind the walls of a cloister or a monastery. He did not attend congresses. His publications did not appear in the leading periodicals of the time, etc. But these explanations are all very doubtful. For another geneticist, applying Mendel's laws to population genetics in 1908, Wilhelm Weinberg did attend congresses, published in leading periodicals, and did not work behind the walls of a monastery, and yet was accepted neither. Stern writes about Weinberg. Weinberg's fate bears comparison to that of Mendel. Both men made their discoveries at a time when their contemporaries were unable to appreciate them. But then, of course, we may ask, why were the contemporaries so unable to appreciate them? Well, the Darwinian schools of biometricians in England was under the leadership of Carl Persson, and he was a totally convinced Darwinian. Now, Weinberg was able to disprove several of the assertions of Persson, which Persson made in 1903 and Ewell in 1906. For example, that the Mendelian rules of heredity were incompatible with the relationships in human populations, and according to Edelman, 1990. And Weinberg was also able to disprove further hypotheses of Persson. And the reaction of Persson was this. Quote, Persson wrote, "A curiously ignorant account of the biometric treatment of heredity has recently been given by Weinberg. It hardly seems needful to reply to criticisms of this sort. But what is the opinion nowadays?" In a site of the North Dakota State University, we read, "The unifying concept of population genetics is the Hardy-Weinberg law, named after the two scientists who simultaneously discovered the law. The law predicts how gene frequencies will be transmitted from generation to generation given a specific set of assumptions. Additionally, some people say that it was not evolution which Mendel was really interested in, but only in hybridism. But listen what Mendel himself has to say. Mendel, quote, "It requires indeed some courage to undertake a labor of such far-reaching extent. This appears, however, to be the only right way by which we can finally reach the solution of a question, the importance of which cannot be overestimated in connection with the history of the evolution of organic form." So, he speaks of the solution in connection with the history of the evolution of organic form. The German corresponding term, Entwicklungsgeschichte, means both ontogeny and phylogeny. Well, so many possibilities are considered today, except the likelihood that the discovery of Mendel and Weinberg were not accepted simply because of the then ruling false ideas of Darwin on heredity and evolution. Well, now let's turn to these wrong ideas of heredity more closely, especially the before-mentioned pangenesis hypothesis.
Yes, Dr. Lohnig, what was Darwin's pangenesis hypothesis, and how were his ideas on heredity so relevant for the non-acceptance of the real laws of heredity?
Well, we find an exceptionally good summary in the Wikipedia, which, you know, is not always safe, and but this is very well done. Quote, "Pangenesis was Charles Darwin's hypothetical mechanism for heredity. He presented this provisional hypothesis in his 1868 work, The Variation of Animals and Plants Under Domestication, and felt that it brought together a multitude of facts which are at present left disconnected by any efficient cause." These are in part quotations by Darwin. The etymology of the word comes from the Greek word pan, a prefix meaning whole, encompassing, and genesis, birth, or genos, origin. And then the article continues, the hypothesis was eventually replaced by Mendel's laws of inheritance. That is absolutely correct. The quotation of the Wikipedia article continued, the pangenesis theory, similarly to Hippocrates' views on the topic, imply that the whole of parental organisms participate in inheredity. That's the perfect pun. While adapting to cell theory, much of Darwin's model was speculatively based on inheritance of tiny hereditary particles, he called gemmules, that could be transmitted from parent to offspring. Darwin emphasized that only cells could regenerate new tissues and generate new organisms. He posited that atomic-sized gemmules formed by cells would diffuse and aggregate in the reproductive organs. So the entire body was viewed to produce these gemmules for the reproductive organs. And some people have joked that is why long married couples become more similar to each other because of the innumerable gemmules accumulated over dozens of years.
So that's why, yeah, right. Yeah.
So this pangenesis hypothesis is what Sebin calls an unfortunate anomaly.
That's very interesting, Dr. Lohnig. So what happened after the laws of heredity were published and accepted after 1900? What was the reaction of the Darwinians to the wide scientific publication and acceptance of those hereditary laws?
Yes, the answer will be given by some quotations according to Nelson, 1927. The data of Mendelian embarrass us very considerably, Corollary. Interesting and profoundly important as are the results of Mendelian investigations, it must be admitted that they have rendered but little assistance in making the evolution process more intelligent. But instead of removing difficulties, have rather increased them, according to Scott. Alfred Russel Wallace, the famous co-discoverer of selection theory, said in 1909, but on the general relation of Mendelism to evolution, I have come to a very definite conclusion. This is that it has no relation whatever to the evolution of species of higher groups, but is really antagonistic to such evolution. Corollary in 1916, quote, it comes to pass that some biologists of the greatest authority in the study of Mendelian principles of heredity are led to the expression of ideas which would almost take us back to creationism, end of quotation. And this, of course, was absolutely impossible in the eyes of all Darwinians. And Bateson himself wrote, Mendelian analysis has not given us the origin of species. It has finally closed off a wrong road. I notice that certain writers who conceive themselves to be doing a service to Darwinism take thereupon occasion to say that they expected as much and that from the first they had disliked the whole thing. Then I'll give an example from the history after the so-called rediscovery. It is the reaction of the totally convinced Darwinian Raphael Weldon. And Povine reports the following, quote, in 1900, C.C. Hurst, who had been experimented with hybridization of orchids, became a zealous disciple of Mendelian inheritance. Hurst was, in Punnett's words, over-apt to find the 3-to-1 ratio in everything he touched. Because of his desire to give the biometricians no room for attack, Bateson was sometimes skeptical of Hurst's claims. In 1906, after a study of wallabies, Gerald Studbook of racehorses, Hurst came to the conclusion that chestnut was a simple Mendelian recessive to Bay and Brown. He wrote a short paper on the subject and asked Bateson to communicate the paper to the Royal Society, which Bateson did, although with some reluctance. End of quote. And now we have to state that due to some circumstances, it happened that the paper was given to Weldon for assessment and review. And Povine explains, quote, Weldon was at this time chairman of the Zoological Committee, and Hurst's paper was submitted to him. he immediately threw himself 9 hours a day into the study of the general stud book, where he found several examples which contradicted Hirst's thesis. These exceptions he dramatically presented after Hirst had read his paper at a meeting on the 7th December 1905. Hirst, standing his ground, blindly asserted Professor Weldon that he was mistaken and that these alleged exceptions were mere errors of entry. This irritated Bateson, and he withdrew Hirst's paper from publication. Later, Hirst discovered that Weldon's most decisive cases were indeed errors of entry. He added a note to his original paper explaining this, and Bateson resubmitted the paper. And now it becomes very interesting. And the question was, what was Weldon's further reactions? What were Weldon's further reactions? Paul Weimer reports, quote, Weldon was outraged and continues his extensive study of the stud book in order to prove that the Mendelian interpretation did not hold. The stud book was in 20 volumes, and Weldon was still working on this material when, after a sudden illness, he died on the 13th April of 1906. Pearson mourned the loss of a friend. He was angry that arguing with the Mendelians had taken so much of Weldon's time. When Hirst wrote Pearson to express his regrets about Weldon, Pearson replied, only a few days before his death, he, Weldon, condemned in stronger language than I ever heard him use of any individual the tone and the contents of the note added to your paper. It is a judgment in which I believe every man who has the interests of science at heart will concur. Now, Kimura, the famous Japanese geneticist on the neutral theory of evolution, comments, it is said that from the strenuous effort to disprove Mendelism by searching for exceptions in the huge volume of stud books of racehorses, Weldon became exhausted, contracted pneumonia, and died in the prime of life, see Pearson's 1906. Well, this tragic happening shows that, as is still the case today, some Darwinists are and were and are totally determined not to accept anything which may contradict their theories. And that's why they needed so long, even to 1937, until the acceptance of the Mendelian laws. So this shows how determined these people were not to accept the discoveries of Gregor Mendel the monk.
Okay, well, Dr. Lohnig, we're running out of time for the second podcast about how Darwinism hindered the acceptance of Mendel's laws of inheritance. Stay tuned for more with Dr. Wolf Eckhard Lohnig. I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.